Duck, duck, goose! Duck and Minerva in stereo.
Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and I'm very pleased to be talking to Stefano Guzzini, whose name for years and years and years I mispronounced as Stefano Guzzini, who has agreed to come on the show today. Stefano, are you there?
Yes, I'm there. Thanks for inviting me, Dan.
Well, thanks for coming on. I always start these things the same way, which is to ask you to give us some of your intellectual biography.
Well, it's always it's a little bit difficult to put it in few words. As you know, professors tend to talk quite long. But so I'm born German, although the Italian name wouldn't really show. My father's Italian, my mother German, and I was born at 5 kilometers from the French border today, in a place of Germany today, which used to be part of France during the First Empire, then parts of Germany again, then under the League of Nations, then it turned to Hitler, then it was under French occupation, and then finally turned back to Germany again. So in a certain sense, both by my migration background of my father and by being born so close to the border, I guess IR almost seems overdetermined as being a major interest in my life. And ex post, with hindsight, it might always look like that, although I guess all our biographies could have turned differently. So I started my education in Saarbrücken, and I didn't really know in which direction to go. I studied both French and contemporary history as much as political science. And I was forced to decide, because political science was only offered for the first 2 years, and afterwards one had to do something else. And I wasn't entirely sure. I didn't want to stay on with French, and so I finally decided to go on with political science, but that meant leaving the university. And for this, I needed money, because my parents didn't have any. And I was lucky enough to get a scholarship. And then I started studying political science in France, quite normally, so to speak, and went to Sciences Po, which I didn't know at all in Paris. So I just went there because it was said to be about political science. I was lucky enough to be taken in the foreigner year before joining the normal diploma program. And I think the 3 years in Paris have been pretty important for what I did afterwards, because they provided me with a socialization, a kind of professional school environment in which one learns about realism and idealism, not because these are theories of IR, but because these are language. This is the common language within which IR is talked, and the kind of meaning world within which we make sense of what world politics is all about. And rather than having any distance to it, I was simply socialized into this language and desperately tried to get some objectifying distance to it. And from then on, I did much theory, which I was not necessarily doing beforehand. And from there, then I moved to the LSE. I was lucky enough to be still under with a fellowship, with a scholarship, and did international political economy, because at least that is the advantage of the French education system. Economics, macroeconomics, not micro, macroeconomics and politics are very well intertwined in the education. Again, for the kind of common language politicians have to use, or public officials and administrators will have to use once they're in their office. And then I, again, was lucky enough to win a scholarship for the European University Institute in Florence, where then I specialized on social and political theory, in particular of international relations and on power. So the setup is really one from somebody who didn't study sociology because I thought it was too theoretical, went into political science believing that it was more practice-oriented, it was better for me. And then when I was hit by the practice of a kind of public policy school, I retreated and tried to get more distance, more observational distance to it, and did much more theory. My first position was at the Central European University in Hungary, in Budapest, for 6 years, between 94 and 2000. Six wonderful years with an international student body I really, really enjoyed, just as much as I did enjoy our student body in Florence being so international. And since 2000, I'm in the north. I have been first working for the Copenhagen Peace Research Institute, and then the merged into in the Danish Institute for International Studies and Uppsala University in Sweden, where I teach. So I have a research position in Copenhagen, a teaching position in Sweden. It's not easy always to commute between the two, but the arrangement works in that I have only a half teaching load in Uppsala, whereas I go on with my research in Copenhagen.
Now, you were telling me before we began recording that you are actually in Torino right now.
That's right. We are on a fellowship, both my wife Anna Leander and I, on a fellowship here at the Collegio Carlo Alberto, which is a small research institution, although now with some fame because the present Minister of Labor in Italy, of the technocratic government here in Italy, is actually coming from here and has her research lab. On labor, on the labor market and pension reform at the Collegio Carlo Alberto. It is mainly interested in economics, but had opened up in the last 2 years also to political science more generally, and it's on that ticket that both Anna and I are now this academic year in Torino.
Now, you've alluded to this a couple of times, but you're actually half of an academic or international relations power couple.
That's right. Anna Leander is she's my wife, I'm her husband. We met in Paris at the time of our studies at Sciences Po, and we were lucky enough to be able to do all our further stops together. So we studied in London. She also took a PhD, an MSc in the politics of the world economy, as it is called there in IBE. We went together to Florence. We had our positions in Budapest, but she is now working in Copenhagen at the Copenhagen Business School in the Department for Politics, Philosophy and Management, which it's a special business school. They also run a deficit as a business school, and they are for free in many of their courses. So it and she likes it very much there. I can talk about her a lot. She is working on private military companies, so there's this business component on the one hand, and in social theory she has been working very much on field theory and Bourdieu, as you know.
So I was thinking back to my first encounter with you or your work, and it was reading a piece that you had published in International Organization, which I read in a seminar my first year in grad school, and that was about power, which has been a major concern of your scholarship. So could you tell us a bit about how you became an influential theorist of power in international politics?
Well, I'm not sure I'm that influential, but it is true that it certainly made up much of my early research life. It was the topic of my PhD, and I'm still supposed to write a textbook or advanced introductory book in this special series that Cambridge has this year, and I finished by the summer at least the first draft. I came into it in a general interest. I guess many people in IR. I used to be a realist, so many people get attracted by the importance of power in the analysis, and I simply wanted to dig a little bit more into it, and I was encouraged to do so at the time at the EUI by Stephen Lukes, who, when I came up with my first research project, which was a kind of sociology of IR theories, he said that sociology of science is the graveyard. The graduate student, and having killed my topic with one sentence, he then proposed that I might go on doing power in international relations because not that much has been written about it in the sense that he believed it should be written, so as a conceptual analysis to some extent. And I first didn't think it was feasible. I thought it was far too wide. I mean, there was an easy explanation why nobody had written about it, because it wasn't possible. But then he nudged me more and more into it. And since Susan Strange was the other supervisor, both of them actually had been working on power. It was not always an easy environment, but it was one in which I could do
such a topic, and I have been doing it with lots of interruptions over the last now almost 20 years.
How would you sum up your contributions to our understanding of power?
Well, the first is that one. I have been confronted, or we all have been confronted, with different power conceptualizations, and there are different ways to dealing with them. One would be the kind of Barnett and Duval. You put them into a typology, and then you say that, well, they can't really be used altogether, but then people and students use them altogether as if they could be just mixed and mingled. Another way to go about it is to say, well, if we take all these components seriously, then we have probably to provide something like a theory behind it that is able to do so. So we cannot have, on the one hand, an individualist approach, and a structuralist approach, and a post-structuralist approach, and just put them on a menu for choice. If you take different parts of this seriously and want to integrate them, how can you possibly integrate them? And that was what my structural power article actually proposed. It proposed to do it in a dyadic conceptualization, because I believe that putting everything which we believe to be important with power into one concept of power would be overloading it. So all the issues about political order, governance, government on the one hand, or agency, cause, ability, dispositions on the other, will go together in a kind of theory of power, but cannot be all within a concept of power, which I believe also to be the mistake by adding just more and more words, structural power, productive power, and so on, to it, because it cannot provide that kind of a coherent theoretical background. And that's what I tried to was in 92, and then it came when it then finally came out, and I tried to do so in a way which, or 93, when I tried to do so in a way which would be taking into account the moves that in social theory have been going on at the time, which later was to be called constructivism. It was already called in 89 by some people, but was not yet a big movement, so to speak. Then there are two other contributions, I believe there are. The one which came out in a Millennium article on the concept of power constructivist analysis in 2005 was to insist on the performative aspect of power. And that is really harking back to this double role IR theories have, both in practice as the common language of international practice and as observational language of theories of social sciences. Because power travels. And power is not innocent. We have no measure of power, because power as a relational concept cannot be really measured, but we invent measures, we construct measures of power, because without them, as Hedley Bull once so nicely put it, it will not work. We need them in our daily politics. But that means that the very definition of power becomes contentious, and a definition of power is therefore not just something which somebody comes up in a little office. It is something which can influence politics. Take the example of Joe Nye's soft power. If the U.S. would believe, or if the U.S. Government would take it that soft power is the most important component for ranking great powerness in international relations, if the Chinese, as Nye is pushing very hard, would end up believing that it is soft power, what kind of military power, which is the most important component for ranking in international relations and therefore for status and so on, well, then it affects profoundly the way that foreign policy is actually done. Also, if whenever we use power, we use it in a performative environment in which it attributes responsibility for action. So in the past, at least, many countries tried to say that they were pretty powerless and therefore not responsible for things that were done in their name or for which they were considered responsible. Only the Bush Jr. administration actually turned it around by trying to say that, they're the only power in town, and so they're the only ones who can actually do something, and therefore they should all be given the responsibility for handling the international system. But again, here the attribution of power is not something which is innocent in political terms. It interacts with politics quite cleanly. And so I've been working on this, on the one hand, the impossible measure of power, but then on the other hand, the power of that measure, which we make up or which we construct in diplomatic negotiation, and for which there are big fightings. I mean, for instance, the Russian government usually doesn't like very much to be told that it is all about soft power in international ranking. And then the third contribution, if you wish, which is the one I'm working on now, is to link this kind of explanatory power analysis back to the theories of power that we used to have at the beginning of political science, which were theories of order. I think there have been two domains within power. Power has been used. On the one hand, it has been used in a kind of more normative environment, political order. Power means also freedom or autonomy on the one hand. And on the other hand, the explanatory one, which I have been covering over the last 20 years, which is about influence, capacity on the one hand, and rule, domination, hierarchy on the other. Now, the two, of course, are connected, but we have somewhat disconnected them most of the time for our analysis. And then over the last 10 years, I could see a kind of rejoinder, both by the Foucauldians, but also by the English school and others. And I think it is, well, whether it's a contribution, it's a big say, but I put at least the focus again back on the fact that these are two domains which are running on different logics and yet have come combined or are on their way of being combined again.
You know, listening to you talk about how you think about your contributions to power analysis and listening to you talk about your intellectual biography earlier, a bunch of things that maybe should have crystallized for me a long time ago are really starting to crystallize, which is the degree to which your work has been consistently concerned with this relationship between theory, as you say, is an observational language. Theory is a way of explaining things that we see going on in the world. But theory also as a language of practice, of performance, of how we narrate, make sense of, and engage with the world, right? So thinking back to the way that you initially talked about learning the languages of realism and idealism and liberalism in a practitioner context, you know, in terms of we should be concerned about the balance of power, or we should be concerned about spreading values, and then those languages becoming, you know, being part of the way in which those ideas are expressed. But then sort of going over to the academic side, and it seems like this has been a current that's run through pretty much everything you've done, particularly some of your very influential criticisms of constructivist theory. So I thought maybe you might talk a little bit more about sort of how you understand the relationship between theory as an observational language and theory as something that we enact, particularly in policy contexts, on the one hand, and how then that becomes a problem for the way that so-called mainstream constructivism developed in the English-speaking world.
I'm not quite sure I can do the last one, so please come back on that one. But it's on the first one for sure, the relationship between theory as common sense, as the in the old and famous Keynes quote, the kind of things that are taken for granted, which set the stage within which authorized debate takes place. That is very much a realism-idealism debate. It's not that this is a single thinking, but automatically we are used to, in any professional context, that whatever we say, we will be automatically cornered into one or the other of these two options, or being considered mixed or worse, muddled, when we don't fit very much into it. So there's no really thinking beyond it. The third one outside is always the one which is excluded as the heterodoxy outside of that particular common sense. The relationship between that one and the observational language is indeed what I have been very much interested in. As you remember, I define realism in my realism book not necessarily just as a theory, but as the attempt to translate practical maxims of basically European diplomacy of the 18th, 19th century into social, into laws of a social science in the United States. And this is a translation which means that you go from practice to theory, from a particular historical context to another context, and also to a different sphere in which other rules of validity pertain, namely in science rather than in political practice. And I think IR is this very special place, and I'm told management is to some extent similar, but it's this very special place where the two are always intertwined. And I cannot really live in a world in which one does just theory without thinking about how that interacts with that world of practitioners, because I can see it interacting all the time. On the other hand, I cannot leave practitioners simply to go on with whatever language they have without acquiring the kind of distance there is. So therefore, I've been asking for a kind of bilingual education, if you wish, from very early. I mean, that people who will be in a professional school, for instance, for IR, should become aware of both of these languages and should not try to reduce one to the other, which is very often done when people say, well, academics speak a language that no practitioners understand, or the academics, when they make their usually arrogant remarks about the limitedness of the meaning system that politicians have. So that's one part, which I believe is relatively important for understanding where I come from, because it means that ideas are not just there for observation, but ideas are to some extent the very subject matter, part of the subject matter of what I'm interested in, because they are influential in IR. Now, to what extent that leads to a criticism of U.S. constructivism, I'm not entirely sure, but maybe you give me one or two words about it so that I can fill in on that one.
Well, I may be connecting dots that aren't there, but I think about your very influential piece in the European Journal of International Relations about kind of the pitfalls and poverty of a lot of what is called constructivism. And as I read it, your argument was, or as if I recall correctly, which I may not be, your argument was more or less that constructivism was increasingly and is increasingly reduced to the idea that norms or ideas or some sort of meaning elements have causal efficacy, right? And you point out that that's not an argument that is at all unique to constructivism, and you do that by looking at some of, say, Steve Krasner's work, among others. And you say that also isn't a particularly constructionist argument in the sense of what we mean when we talk about social construction. And as I read it, part of what you say is that for constructivism to be a serious approach to the idea that the world is socially contingent rather than naturally necessary, that requires attention to this kind of double hermeneutic, this relationship between theories of practice and the practice of theory, and the way in which ideas not only sort of shape politics, but which the process of theorizing is in fact productive of political relations.
Well, I think I couldn't have put it better. I mean, obviously, Dan, you have more experience in putting things shorter than I. And I think that's right. I think you're very right. I didn't think that there was anything specific to constructivism. It was reduced to the moreover allegedly causal effect of ideas. Explanation. And it is right that I insist very early on this relationship between the social construction of knowledge, so if you wish, the epistemological component of constructivism, with the construction of social reality, i.e. the ontological component of constructivism. I believe that the if you don't take into account this looping effect, which you just talked, I use this word, or the interactive effect between knowledge and practice, then you miss what the specificity of constructivism is. That doesn't mean that this is always the relevant question for all issues of research in international relations, but it can sometimes be. And it's one to which one should be alerted at the start, because it might in fact be the biggest political component in there. I mean, it's a nice irony, in fact, that constructivism, which is also theoretical, is in fact very much about this, it could have been otherwise, and therefore is highly, implicitly at least, highly political and connected to the political environment. And indeed, it draws its justification or its significance, I believe, very often from there. Because honestly speaking, constructivism is rather trivial in its basic ideas. Most people would not think it was wrong. Constructivists would have a much harder time because they would need to defend empirically where the difference would be significant enough that it makes sense to make this kind of constructivist analysis. I think that there are many topics in which it does make a huge difference, but it's not something which can be taken for granted at the beginning. So I think it's triviality is to some extent a problem for constructivism. And but then, since most people or many people do not buy it, we can still go on having these useless ism wars.
Well, that raises there are a couple of directions that we could go now, but that raises an issue that's been really kind of a hot topic in the IR blog sphere and IR Twitter sphere recently, which is the status of international relations theory. And I know that you are one of a number of people, some of whom are sort of actively participating in this debate online, who did a piece for the end of IR theory panels and for the end of IR theory symposia, which is in some sort of state now of review. So I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about how the question of how you think about the question of, you know, IR theory, what is it good for, but also how your perspective might be different from, you know, so people in a lot of the blog discussion that I've been involved with has primarily concerned, you know, Walt Mearsheimer's, you know, piece, to some degree, stuff that Patrick and I have been saying. Steve Seideman had a very negative and highly read reaction to the Walt Mearsheimer piece. But all of this has really been from the perspective of the Western side of the Atlantic Divide. And so one of the things that I thought might be interesting in pressing you is not just sort of what you have to say about these topics, but how this looks different from the other side of the pond, so to say, speak.
I'm not quite sure I would know exactly the U.S. So the differences you will have to draw yourself, or the audience will have to draw a little bit on its own. I think that the discussion about the end of IR theory caught me a little bit by surprise. I mean, I know that the increasing professionalization of IR means that theory in terms of political theory has been on the defensive. So empirical generalizations, or the generalization of empirical generalization, is fine. That is theory as it should be. The other types of theorizing, and there are quite a number, have had it a little bit more difficult. And that would include normative theorizing, by which you try to look and discuss in terms of ideal, morally ideal states of affairs. So it would be more a philosophy in the liberal tradition or in the cosmopolitan tradition, and so on. It is meta-theoretical theorizing, the type of Wendtian theorizing, mostly known, but also elsewhere, in which you would try to look at the underlying assumptions of different theories and how they come together. And that has often been connected to the isms debate, because it's there where you find some coherence, meta-theoretical coherence to the isms that there are. And then there is also empirical theory, which is more done on a conceptual way. I think I sometimes refer to this as a kind of ontological theorizing. If you take Bull's Anarchical Society, he's really brutal in the sense that every chapter starts with the chapters would be called Balance of Power, all the institutions, Balance of Power, International Law. And the first, he has three questions, I think, always at the start. And the first one is, what is the balance of power? What is international law? What is a great power? And so on. And of course, this is an empirical question on the one hand, but it's a hugely theoretically laden question at the other, because the way you come up to define what it is in the end is theory driven. So it's a part of empirical studies, which is surviving quite well, of course, in the English school, and to some extent also in the German context, I believe, and in the Scandinavian, but which I see a little bit less perhaps in the United States, or its status is not necessarily seen as very high in the United States. I might be wrong on this, because there's also not one audience, it's not one US, it's not one Europe, so I one should be very careful about these kind of generalizations.
Well, I think just to sort of provide a tentative answer to that, one of the paradoxes that people are really noting about North American, and particularly United States international relations, is that on the one hand, the general sense is that the tide has turned against most of those kinds of theorizing that you describe, right? So that the what really we talk about when we talk about a vibrant zone of theory is, you know, middle range theory, explanatory theory. But at the same time, if you look at the people who are consistently ranked most influential in some of the surveys, and the people whose voices seem to be the loudest in across the discipline, they also happen to be people who are thought of as theorists. So this, whether or not that's a generational lag issue, and that's going to increasingly change as, you know, younger scholars who are now in their 40s and their 30s rise in prominence, and some in their 50s, or whether that's, you know, sort of a kind of inherent paradox to the business, you know, is something that remains to be seen. But that is, I think, worth noting in the context of what you're saying. So,
yeah, I think that's perfectly right. And you are, and I think there might be a generational shift on the one hand, and this is surely less pronounced in Europe, where you would still have across generations both traditions. I mean, it's not to say that there's only the one or only the other. And I think many of the leading recruitments recently, both at the in the UK, but also on the continent, as they say, they rather point into a direction. I mean, you have been interviewing Eva Neumann, got the Montague Burton professorship at the LSE, and they are the recruitments I can see in Germany recently seem to indicate that there's a quite healthy mix still around, and that you can have a career, although not necessarily an easy one, if you are relatively theory laden. And your split is perfectly right. On the other hand, the most respected scholars will be respected because at least at one point in their career, they have made a major theoretical contribution. They might not necessarily go on with that all the time, but they must have made that at some point, at least in their career. And I think that covers also people like Thomas Risse, who would be known for his use of Habermas, and perhaps and would derive much of the status, at least for the outsiders, from there, although for within Germany, then he has done much more over the last decades, and that would give him a certain status within the discipline, say. Now, I can see all of that, but then the end of theory is, of course, it doesn't work in the sense that theory is always there, and one should insist heavily on the constitutive component of theorizing, i.e., on the one hand, you have a very instrumental use, if and then, so that tries to find mid-range contingent causalities, probabilities, and that will help also in order, basically, when you have a problem, you get a screwdriver or get the necessary instrument in order to solve it. But very often, of course, theory is more important for defining the problem in the first place, or what is to be a problem in the first place. Besides the fact, as I mentioned beforehand, that this is a huge political issue and that links immediately academia back to the political sphere. And that constitutive function of theory is always there. And the students usually have no troubles understanding it. Once they understood how important that is, they also get very much interested in the assumptions which make them tick the way they do or they did before they started thinking about it. And I have troubles to imagine that part will somewhat drop out. Maybe the professionalization will make it more complicated. There's a huge competition, not as much as in the US, but there is still a high competition for jobs in Europe, and you will have to measure them in one way or the other, and that might be easier to measure if your assessment is based upon something that everybody else can follow according to the methodologies of the day, whereas it's more complicated if you have the pure theoretical assessment, if there are less theoreticians or theorists around. I don't know. I feel indeed that there's pressure building up, that one needs to justify and apologize for being a theorist. That's perfectly true. It should not happen, but it sometimes does. On the other hand, I think it to be wrong to whine about that position, because I believe that it is hard for almost everyone in the field these days, whether theorist or not.
So essentially, it sounds to me like you're pretty dismissive of the premise, or that the premise, if it identifies some specific set of issues like difficulty in finding a job or getting published, that these are kind of basically universal problems. And, you know, it's only by ignoring that these problems are happening elsewhere do you come up with the idea that IR theorists or IR theory are in particular trouble.
theory in the social science is in trouble. I mean, I it's not to say that it is. I don't want to give the impression that, as I said, I have to be apologetic. People don't understand it, and there is a component within the field which feels authorized to look down on somebody who does only theory, as if only theory was inferior to do only whatever empirical generalizations as theory. I think that pressure is there in some environments, but it is also true that there are many pockets, particularly in the UK, but also elsewhere, where that's not the case. And so it's always very hard to say. I think at the very top, so moving up perhaps for some of the Ivy League universities or some other universities in the US, it might be tougher than it is in on the European side. So I don't want to entirely against the premise, because I can see it how it works out in the US in particular, and as you rightly said, less in Canada. But then it doesn't all apply so easily for all the European environments. I wouldn't think so.
And I would say, in defense of some of the people who might be looking down their nose at pure theory now, or people who are primarily theorists, is that they suffered on the other end of that stick for quite some time, being dismissed by people for, by being dismissed as inferior to the people who were doing IR theory. And that's been one of the subtexts of the argument over the Wald and Mearsheimer contribution, or the Mearsheimer and Wald contribution, is essentially a sense that it's extraordinarily dismissive of people who are doing primarily middle range, explanatory work as somehow not worthy, or their work not really, having any implication for what the theorists are doing, which is a way of saying, that the theorists are committed to their particular theoretical perspective, and they're never going to move no matter how many times you might show that they're wrong. But another aspect of your work that I thought would be really interesting to talk about, and something that we've had conversations about, now and then over the years, has been your work on geopolitics.
Well, there's that work. Yeah, it's just, in a certain sense, it's a strange but a long-term project. When I was teaching in Budapest in the mid-90s, so just after the end of the Cold War, we all very happy, the whole thing is over. Here we have new societies being able to express themselves in a different manner. Europe is no longer this continent where you had to apply for zillions of visas and get even more invitations, but could actually start to travel and reunite, in fact, a continent which had been somewhat artificially being divided. But then at the same time, I could see that arguments as done by, say, Zbigniew Brzezinski or by Samuel Huntington would have a huge heyday immediately. So that in some of the countries, say Romania, for instance, but also for a while in Estonia, these arguments would come in as if they were God-given. I mean, there was a very strange from Marx to Mackinder. And I was puzzled by this. I would not have expected in a moment when, remember, at that time, not even realism was able to really counter the critique that it didn't say very much interesting things about the end of the Cold War, that has changed a little bit afterwards, that something even more materialist, even more determinist would come up, rear its more or less ugly head and become so famous, and not only in Central Eastern Europe, because it turned out to be also in some other parts of Europe, say Italy, where all of a sudden Carlo Jean, a general, who has been writing already beforehand, published one geopolitics book after the other. Now, in order to understand that puzzle, I got a research group together, which was extremely courageous to stay with me for many, many years, because funding wasn't very easy to get, and so we didn't get very much, and we made a comparison of the reasons which why that might have happened. Why in a moment of where the Wendtians would say we are all moving towards an anarchy, a Kantian culture of anarchy, all of a sudden people were getting and move towards the other direction. And the explanations could be, well, there is no puzzle whatsoever. Mearsheimer, Back to the Future, Center, it's Yugoslavia, and it's Europe coming back to its old roots. But then not in every country in Europe geopolitics had made its inroads. And if realism was not good enough to understand the end of the Cold War, it is not quite clear why it would be all of a sudden so great in order to understand everything which follows. And so the explanations we found in the end was mainly a constructive explanation, namely that geopolitics as a theory allegedly has a kind of driving determinism, which is a naturalist or objectivist, or they say environmental determinism in geography, which provides a very easy orientation and reference point in moments in which foreign policy identities or roles, i.e. self-identifications on the one hand and role recognition from the international society on the other, might be in shambles. And the Cold War indeed asked new questions because the countries or their foreign policy had to redefine themselves. And so we called it ontological insecurity or foreign policy identity crises, and followed them through six case studies across the European continent. And on the basis of which, then I also developed in the two rather long chapters at the end, an analysis in terms of an interpretivist process tracing, in which I tried to use causal mechanisms within a constructivist framework, but having obviously to redefine them so that they fit the meta-theoretical assumptions of constructivism. And I do that just as much as I wanted to take power, if you wish, from a realist monopoly. I think one should not leave causality in general to a positivist philosophy of science, because causality in different manners also applies to more interpretivist approaches, or so I believe. And I try to do that by developing two mechanisms. One is a kind of ontological dissonance reduction, i.e. that there will be automatically different ways of trying to put the identity discourse into coherence again. And so it's in a little bit in an analogy with the cognitive dissonance reductions. Here it would be on the discursive level, on the identity constructions that need to be made more coherent again. And there are different ways in a mechanism how to do that. And the other one, the obvious self-fulfilling prophecy mechanism, which one could have expected, which was the normative starting point of the analysis, i.e. we were at the end of the Cold War, but if everybody believed in geopolitics again, well, then we would produce basically a new security agenda, which was just as, in a different manner, just as geopolitics-oriented that the Cold War used to be.
So in a sense, the way to understand a lot of – I mean, it's interesting because this tracks very much with what I find interesting – I'm sort of trying to articulate this in a clean way – in many ways, what you've just said would be, I think, a kind of – would tap into a kind of conventional wisdom in policy circles about the proliferation of geopolitical frameworks at the end of the Cold War and then in the wake of September 11th and other events that created a kind of unsettled – environment for foreign policy. I'm thinking about the U.S. in particular, but obviously in a lot of other places as well, right? That, you know, a lot of people attempted to make sense of these moments by pitching or resuscitating theoretical frameworks. But that's something that, you know, the more I think about it, hadn't at least until your work, been fully theorized or treated as a kind of scholarly issue, right? I mean, it's what, you know, if I were to get on, you know, it's what any kind of national security analyst would tell you, but it's not necessarily what, you know, at least in an explanation for all the proliferation of grand strategic frameworks, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not something that we actually paid much attention to within IR, which I think it's turned around to be very unfortunate in the sense that that when these frameworks have actually gotten a purchase on policy, it's made an enormous difference in terms of the kinds of actions the United States or other states have taken, whether, in fact, the United States or Russia or now we're paying a lot of attention to what kinds of frameworks are becoming predominant in China. So, you know, but still, again, even I think not at the level of deep theorization, more at the level of everybody kind of knows this is important and most of that discussion is not, in fact, happening in scholarly journals. That's my sense, anyway. Why this kind of disconnect, right, between sort of something that we all kind of know is extremely important, that we all kind of have an intuitive notion of, you know, yes, unsettled foreign policy moments produce searches for frameworks that make sense of them. Those frameworks are highly consequential. Geopolitical frameworks often have a lot of purchase at those moments. If you think about some of the most successful ones in the 90s, they were geopolitical. They were subconsciously resurrecting geopolitics. And yet, there's this paucity of this stuff, I think, in academic IR.
Well, there are probably two reasons. On the one hand, it's on the, and it's always the two levels of IR, the diplomatic practice on the one hand, on the academic observation on the other. And the diplomatic practice, the geopolitical revival will be seen simply as the payback moment in which the realist-idealist pendulum is going one way and then going the other way. So you would say, look, think about Rumsfeld's famous, we don't know what we don't know, which is worst-case thinking pushed to the extreme. It's perfectly meaningful. There's nothing funny about it. It's perfectly meaningful. And it is at that moment of insecurity that you think in terms of the worst case that there is, which is purely potential, and of course then can, in a self-fulfilling prophecy, produce that very worst case. We know that at the level of observation. Wolfers had been writing about this. I mean, you don't have to go constructivists, the old realists are enough for that. But on the level of diplomatic practice, we will try to remedy this in the old realist-idealist debate. So it will not be geopolitics as, oh, a theory which comes in when we need suddenly some help, but it would be as the vengeance, because we have the not really understood before, and be careful, because if we don't take it into account, then something very bad will happen in the future. On the level of observation, it's quite interesting because, of course, geopolitics was left to geopoliticians, except for, and here there is a difference, in political geography. So what I found out during the long years of making this comparative study is that the critical geographers, they have worked on this for a very long time. But in IR, we don't read them very much. They read actually pretty okay IR people, but there's not that much the other way around, with the exception of the UK, where many of the IR people have also migrated to geography departments and vice versa, where there's more of an interrelationship between the two. They have theorized this this geopolitical imagination, the rise of geopolitical imagination in moments of crisis for quite a while. But what I was particularly interested in this is not that just there is more geopolitics coming up, but people were actually referring to Haushofer, they were referring to Mackinder, they were referring to the good old guys, and so there was a strong attempt across several countries of looking at the merits of this old tradition when we had now to rethink the future of Europe after the end of the Cold War. So yes, there has been disregard, but I think that's partly also because we are so departmentalized. And if we, as I had to, because the political geographers didn't leave me alone with it, when they told me, look, for us, this is actually no puzzle whatsoever. And we have already observed it from the outside. We have actually done already our homework. There was quite a lot to read. And I mean, John Agnew or Gerard Toal or the critical geopolitics school, which is much bigger by now, they have gone far wider in the construction of space and matter than most of the constructivists in IR have been going.
Yeah, I mean, I need to amend what I said earlier in case I create the wrong impression. There are canonical works on that try to explain systematically the adoption of various grand strategies, and there are even more recent works, but there is not, I think, what you're talking about, this work that really takes very seriously the texture of those worldviews, in particular the geopolitical, the sort of constant return of geopolitics and when it returns. Gerard keeps on sending me pieces or links to conferences for critical geography or geography that's engaged in these kinds of issues. And it does strike me that there's a lot going on there, which is ahead of the curve in terms of where sort of European style or critical constructivists are thinking, or even, you know, mainstream constructivists, and yet it is completely, you know, outside the conversation. And you say this is departmental politics, but that doesn't entirely explain things, precisely because they seem to pay attention to the IR side of things, even if we don't pay attention to them. So what would account for that difference?
I don't know. Usually it is. I would not know. I mean, sometimes political science has disclosure towards IR. Might have to discuss what the relationship between political science and IR is, and then IR has gotten big enough to have an audience within itself. It reaches out to many other disciplines, be it for economics on the one hand, political theory, or sociology on the other, as we had in the constructivist line. Geography has been left very often out, I guess, mainly for the reason that it was connected to military strategic planning or to realism, and this last move to the more the political geographers have moved after 45 actually quite decisively away from much of this, exactly for its difficult political undertones. Their geopolitics has been handled in a far richer manner, and I don't know, it is changing. I mean, among our contributors there was one political geographer who did the case study on Estonia, Merje Kuus. And as I said, in the UK, there is much more cross-fertilization across those departments. Sometimes IR scholars would be actually, as I said, in geography departments rather than in political science or IR, whatever the department structure in that UK university is. It is more complicated on the continent, where geography might also sometimes be not as pushing, let me put it this way, as that particular branch would be, in particular, again, in the UK or in parts of the US.
I want to close by asking you a different sort of question about critical geopolitics and geography, which is that you've had a very long association. Well, you've been involved in various ways and have with what we might call European IR, but also national IR. So if you think about where your position now, right, you're in Torino, but you have joint appointments in Copenhagen at DIS, and then also at Uppsala. You got your PhD at the University, European University Institute Florence, and you were at, as you mentioned, at Budapest, at Central European University. You were also the person to really take the Journal of International Relations and Development, JIRD, and start to put it on the map as in terms of your role with that was part of the broader role that you had in the Central and East European International Studies Association. And you've been on the Standing Group of International Relations of the ECPR. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, certain things like, you know, is there a European IR, or are we still talking about kind of national IR program, you know, sort of national IR? And what has, in regardless, what's sort of been changing or not changing over the last 10, 15 years, and what kinds of things are we likely to see moving forward in terms of that intellectual milieu?
Well, if I had the answer to all of that, I think...
Pick and choose as you would like.
I think as a... Well, the sociologist in me would say, of course, there are national versions of IR because the way that department structures are organized, funding is organized, the way that students or student fees are organized make a difference for the relationship between, say, IR and political science, or the independence of IR more generally. And there are historical traditions of the way that you do political science, which will have an influence on the particular national trajectory. So there is a national component, if you wish, simply by the way that there's a particular context within which it takes place. But that is not one which makes it incommunicable to anybody else, quite to the contrary. I think that there has been over the last, ever since the Standing Group had its first conference in 92, so over the last 20 years, there has been an increasing interconnectedness in the European IR scene, and the that is visible between the Scandinavians and the Germans, and you can also see it even with new people coming up in the is, I think, correctly still called a kind of periphery of IR, which is the East or the South in Europe, in which many people try to build up new departments, be it now in Ljubljana, in Prague, or now in Warsaw, in Tartu. They have a wonderful initiative trying to move forward, or in, say, Italy or Spain and Portugal, in which I spent quite a little bit of time going for PhD workshops or for giving conferences to the local ISAs, for linking up. Because it is, of course, a two-way story. I learned quite a bit by going to the so-called semi-periphery from where I come. I mean, I come from a small German university in which political science was dead after 2 years, and they have closed by now the political science department. So I know what the situation is. So there is more linkages going on. I'm not quite sure whether that means anything in a kind of common European IR approach. I actually would hope it would not mean anything in that direction, so that different approaches survive and cross-fertilize rather than there's this kind of one-way thinking. And that certainly has happened for the last 20 years. There are still some generational fights going on in terms of older departments being defined either with very marginal roles for IR or if IR is in there in a very particular manner. And there are generational fights, particularly at those and the more semi-peripheral parts of Europe, in which younger generations, which have read up incredibly large, and which come with their own luggage and baggage, would like to make a difference to the university where they are in, but the structures are not always allowing it. Allowing it. So that will certainly go on. It happened at some earlier stage also in, say, Germany or in the Scandinavian countries. I refer to that part because the British part has always been very developed and has been always flourishing to some extent. And by now, IR departments are sometimes as big, if not bigger, than political science departments over there. So that has always had its own development and nicely and autonomously. But the other parts of continent is picking up. Where that will go in the future, I'm not entirely sure. I just hope that the Erasmus program, which was just saved, at least to some extent, and the further interlinkage will allow the Europeans to become more aware of the different views that they are and that they are communicated to each other, and not just by sitting in association meetings in which you have to always a taken representative from whatever part of Europe there is, but rather from the content side, because you be assured that the way the European Union is looked at and researched these days in the southern part of Europe is changing, and that the kind of feedback that has is extremely important for other countries within Europe. So I just hope that there's more going on in that direction, and that this also that the new generations that would be also younger than us are successful in pushing for more change. And I see actually quite a high number of motivation, and it's this unbelievable idealism of people in academia who basically go for a career which in many countries doesn't pay and doesn't give much of a security, and yet want to make that difference happen. And I can see it also with the students, not just in Budapest, which was a very selected crowd, but also elsewhere, that there's a remarkable curiosity, and honestly, there's enormous human capital. I mean, it is not simply not true that, or I don't know who believes that anyway, but it's simply not true that it is in the center only that you find the big brains, so to speak. They are all over, and they are nicely distributed in the human genome, if you wish. And it is just nice to see that some of them are able to make their voices heard, and I hope, and I cannot predict that this will happen, but I hope more of this will come from parts of Europe in which they had not yet had that opportunity.
Well, that sounds like as good an, you know, that sounds like a rousing way to end this, both with a kind of a hope for the future and some optimistic or cautiously optimistic sense of where this is all headed. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this again. I really enjoyed it, and I hope that you will come on again in some capacity.
Oh, sure. Thanks very much, Dan. Right,
thanks. And thus ends episode 18 of the Duck of Minerva podcast. This episode was recorded on January 14th, 2013, and featured Stefano Guzzini. That's all, folks.